Afternoon, my name is Amos Nakohol. It's a great honor for somebody to ask me to speak on AA's 70th birthday, and for for somebody to even ask me that just, you know, blew me away. I've owed my life as it is today to the program Alcoholics Anonymous. It's changed the way a person completely from being, you know, I used to say I hated white people. Then I thought about it, you know, and I hated about everybody, you know, equally. And I wasn't prejudiced. I just hated everybody, you know, and I didn't like the situation I grew up in. A lot of things happened that before I was born that shaped my life, and I was brought into that world, and I always said, you know, if you was the way, you know, in my situation and had to face the things I faced, you'd be an alcoholic too. But I came to Las Vegas with that attitude. I was forever a victim, and I could always put it off saying, well, I'm an Indian. If you was Indian like me, then, you know, all that stuff, you could understand I drank, you know, and I was 2 years dry when I got here, and I ended up in this, I was kind of lost. This Thai club used to have two buildings, and in the back was this dilapidated part of Thai club, and there was some old benches, old couches that were real sunk down, and all, you know, smoky, and all the old farts in there always looked like they were fighting, ready to fight, you know, arguing. And I had this friend that took me to that meeting, and George was part of that group, you know. They started taking this victim stuff right out of me. I always explained, well, there's 10 of us in my family, and 9 are alcoholic. You know, the one that didn't drink should be drinking. And, they'd say, well, what about the one that didn't drink? Did she ever go to jail? And I said, no. In fact, I said, she finished college and she's working for IBM. So she's never drank and she's never gone to jail. Never done the stuff you've done. I said, nope. They said, well, then not all Indians are alcoholics. You know? And then they said, Amos, you know what? You're dying from alcoholism. You're not dying from Indianism. You know? And they started taking the victimization out of me. And I didn't like that. You know, I get a lot of mileage out of being a victim, you know. I could get away with stuff, you know. But what these guys done is they started just making me a little bit more honest. Making me more, a little bit more responsible for my actions. A little bit more responsible for, going to work on time. You know, doing the things I gotta do, like pay my rent. And I'd come in with these all kinds of stories, and they'd laugh and say, you know what, Amos, you could tell it to somebody else, but you ain't gonna tell that to us, you know. We know you too good. So that started to change in me. You know, I was full of fear. I was full of hatred. I was full of anger, and I was, you know, scared most of the time of things I couldn't do anything about. What these guys done to me is that they introduced me to the program Alcoholics Anonymous and started doing the steps. And they started the process of learning there's a higher power in my life, and that if I learn to do the right things and learn to trust in Him, things will work out. And then it's been a long process. You know, I've learned how to get a life as a result of these guys. You know, my life was beer joints and back alleys and blood banks and day labor and jail and anything between that, you know. And through these guys, you know, they started the process of making me a more responsible person, not necessarily a better person, you know. That comes with time. Now I'll kind of give you where I came from. I came from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. It's in the southwest corner of South Dakota. And growing up there, I didn't know it was such a horrible place, because it was just normal. Everybody drank on any weekend. You know, it was not safe to be around my house or anywhere near the vicinity. You know, I'm the sixth brother. There's five older brothers than me, and they're all bigger than me and meaner. And you know, because I learned how to run quickly, you know, when I was a kid. I learned how to hide and I learned to duck. And one of my brother's biggest recreation was cleaning out a bar on the weekend, you know. That's what he liked to do for fun, you know. And my dad was alcoholic, my mom. The only one that didn't drink that I know was my sister and my grandma. And my grandma was one of the cornerstones of my life, you know. We didn't know how old grandma was. You say, "Grandma, how old are you?" She said, 89. She was 89 for about 20 years, so you know, we didn't know how old she was. But she could tell you back before the white guys came to our part of the country. You know, and she could talk all day long. She talked in her, we call it Sioux. It's Lakota, you know, the language. So I didn't talk English till I went to school. And I thought, you know, and she'd tell us all kinds of stories, you know, and I respected grandma because she had a cane, and, you know, and he didn't listen to grandma. She'd lay it on side of you, you know, on side of your head. You know, she didn't, there were 10 of us in my family, so my mom didn't know counseling or any of that kind of stuff. Either you did it or you was on the ground, you know. And on weekends, my older brother would go to, they worked all week, and on weekends they'd go to town, and then they'd see who they'd get in a fight with at the bar, and if they couldn't find anybody there, they'd come home and get in a fight with each other, you know. And then my dad would be refereeing, you know, and I'm saying, man, I don't know if this is normal living, but that's the way I grew up. And it was okay. I don't know if it was okay or not, but I was, the U.S. government formed this branch of government called the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And their job was to make us white guys, to assimilate us into society. And in the BIA, we call it Boss Indians Around, you know. Their job was to make you a white guy. How could you do that, you know? Hundreds of years of culture and everything like that. You're supposed to become a white guy within about two or three weeks, you know? How that could happen. I went to this boarding school. I just turned 6 years old. And they said, okay, first of all, they lined us up just like a boot camp. You know, took your clothes away from you, shaved you bald, and then assigned you numbers and gave you beds. And then the first thing they say is, well, you can't talk your language anymore. You've got to learn how to speak English. And then you get punished pretty bad for speaking your language. And then next thing they did is, okay, whatever beliefs you had, you don't got them anymore. They all lined us all up like in a row. They said, you guys are Episcopals and you guys are Catholics. I was like, what the hell Episcopal is? But it was bad, you know. Because I was going to go someplace for being a human being, you know. Someplace hot, someplace horrible. And I'm a boy. I got thoughts, okay, you know. And then I'm supposed to go to some place I couldn't even understand what this thing is. But every weekend they'd make us get in these little suits and they'd march us down to this church and then tell us about how we're going to go to this burning inferno, you know, for things we didn't even know we'd done. And then go back and then they tell us, your culture's no good. You know, your language is no good. You're going to have to learn this English language. You're going to have to learn to work. You're going to have to do all this stuff. And you're supposed to accomplish that. And then when you get out of there, you're supposed to go out there in society and then start being a productive human being, right? Well, it don't work. First of all, when they start doing that stuff to you, you start getting what you call self-loathing. You start getting what you call low self-esteem. You start hating yourself for who you are. And you got nothing to do with this stuff. And it prepared me to a life of an alcoholic, because I had no higher power. I had nobody to turn to when I get through these situations where most normally you say, okay, it's God's will. Me, I'll say it's the damn Christopher Columbus should have never got lost, you know. You know? Or it's the U.S. government or the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the cops, you know. I never knew that my actions would get me in these situations. And I ended up, you know, I finished that boarding school. I graduated high school, and I barely graduated the last 2 years, you know, because by that time my mom passed away, and I didn't have nowhere to go during the school. So I'd go back to the boarding school and hang out just because I had nowhere to go. And so I graduated, and then what do you think I did when I graduated? I was drinking hard by then. So a few of my brothers lived in Denver. And they were on their way down, and they drank at a place called Larimer Street. You know? And I went down, I was 18 years old, 19 years old, when I was down Larimer Street. I loved it down there. Yeah, this is just a free-for-all, 24 hours a day. And I did, you know, because it still worked for me at times, the alcohol. It still worked for me. It still took away the situations I was in. It took away reality for a time being. And I was down there for off and on the streets like that and for the next 10 years. You know, I got all kinds of scars and, you know, I'm lucky I'm alive, you know. And in that time I went I went down to California. Then I went to Phoenix. I went to Albuquerque and went back to Denver. All in that situation. Always in the same situation. Always like two notches above the street. Always like having a couple, two, three warrants over my head. Always looking over my shoulder. Cops are looking for me. You know, I went to one of these Big Shot AA meetings one time. They asked this question. The question is, when do you think you got to move, right? And I said, that's easy. When you got more warrants than you could pay, you know. That's when you move, you know. You know, and I just lived that way. I didn't know that there was another way of living. I didn't know. My whole family were alcoholics. Everywhere I went, there was an alcoholic. And when there was a situation, I settled it the way I was doing. I either ran, I got drunk, and I always ended up in trouble. And I wish I could tell you different, but that's the way I grew up. A lot of my people grew up that way. On the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, the average age, the age that the people live is like 40 years old. That's the longest they're gonna live. And most of that's gonna be in misery. And it's one of the biggest ghettos you've ever seen. It's like 100 miles, 150 miles long. And most people die by the time they're in their 30s. Because of this disease, car accidents, death, shootings, knifings, freezing to death. Most of the guys I went to high school with are dead. And, you know, I'm 51 now. I go back, they call me an elder. You know, and that's kind of bad because then I'm only 51 and most people don't make it my age. That's a bad disease. It'll kill most of my people. And I'm really fortunate that I ended up where I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, you know, I ended up standing on a street corner. I lived two blocks off of Larimer Street under a tree. And that was my home. And it was a good morning. I'd get up and I'd have a jug of white port that I'd kind of choke down. And I'd go down and start blaming everybody else for where I'm at. But that morning I was standing. I didn't have any. So I was standing in the corner with my buddies, the boys, you know, at the corner. And here somebody scored a jug, white port, and passed it around, and I took a drink, and it went down, and I was just hit my stomach, and I was just, eyes are watering, and then I didn't want to throw it up, and it's coming out of my nose, and you know, and if you hold it down, then maybe the magic will hit, and then you could start saying, okay, and damn Christopher Columbus, you know, and you start blaming everybody else, and but that morning it did stay down, but I. You know, I was tired. I started looking around, started seeing I've been doing this stuff all my life, you know, and I'm tired and I'm sick and I don't want to do this anymore, you know, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say there's a higher power and he intervenes, you know, in people. And in the big book, it says about this Eskimo who's going to show up. Well, my Eskimo was another buddy of mine, a Sioux Indian. He's calling me from across the street and I lost my glasses, so I couldn't see who it was, but in my situation, you don't go across the street, somebody's calling you. You probably did something wrong, you know. You probably stole something or did something. And so I went over there for some reason that morning. It was Harley. Harley said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I don't know." You know, where's your daughter? I said, "I don't know." You know, "What you gonna do?" I really don't know. You know, and he said, "You know, I've been sober 14 months," and that blew me away because Harley and I, we drank together. We drank hard. Our only claim to fame is we got kicked out of every bar we ever been in, and we even got kicked out of the parking lots too, you know. The people just didn't want us around, he said, "If you go to this place called Eagle Lodge for 30 days, I'll help you get a job, and we'll go find your daughter," you know. And I had no ideas, so I said, "Okay." And I went into this place called Denver Saves. You know, this detox we got down there is a good detox compared to Denver Cares, you know. It's a room, a big old warehouse, converted warehouse. They have cots lined up just like a warehouse, you know. And they have people in there. They just house men and women together, you know. And you go in there and they detox, you know. They take your clothes away, give you a shower, de-louse you, and then they give you these pajamas on. And then you go over there and you detox, however long it takes. And they have doctors and nurses and stuff available to, you know, help you out, get through that. And I was, you know, every time I bent over, man, it was bad. You know, I drank for about a year straight that time. You know, and I went in there and I was sick. I just couldn't hardly move. And I was there about 3 days when the other thing that happened in my life is that the other part of Alcoholics Anonymous came I was laying there and I was looking around and I said, "What are you doing here, you know? I thought you started out to do better than this." And then it hit me that, you know what, Amos, you drink too much. When you drink, you don't care. You don't really give a shit. And you go to the end of the earth to get another one. And that time they brought these AA meetings and I went to one and didn't really sink in, but I knew these guys were happy, you know, and I knew they were laughing, you know. And after the AA meeting, they'd get in their car and go home. You know, they were paying their bills. And if you give me any money at that period of time, I wasn't gonna pay no bill. I'd go down to the corner liquor store. And that was the appeal of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things that happened to me, I was standing there in line with this guy to eat, and I was talking to him, I turned back around and his eyes rolled up and he hit the dirt and he was just flopping all over the place. And the ambulance came, they took him away, and then when they brought him back, he couldn't talk. He went through a seizure and he couldn't talk anymore and he could barely walk. And he's the same age as me, and it just scared me. It's one of the things that made me think that I drink just as I was drinking the parks with him. I drink just like him. There he is, he can't walk, can't hardly talk. And I start realizing that, you know what, I need to do what these guys say in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I need to find out what these guys do to make them be happy and make them have a life. So from there I went to the Eagle Lodge Alcohol Treatment Center and you know, and I'm real prejudiced. I've worked hard on this for a lot of years, you know. And one of my best friends sitting out there is a cowboy, you know. Indian hugging a cowboy. You know, that's good. But every time I go to an AA meeting, I'm the only Indian there, right? So I'm always, okay, there's my excuse, you know. This AA is for white guys only. So I said, well, there's my excuse. And so there I was stumbling through the book. They have this book, right? I was stumbling through it and then opened to this chapter called Join the Tribe in the third edition. And then, and there it says, that there's a guy named Maynard. He was in there. And then just hit me and I said, you know what? If he's in there and he could do this, I can try it too. And I could, and he says, just keep it real simple. He says, if Indians get crazy when drunk, you know, join the tribe, you know. I'm sure all of us got crazy when it got drunk, you know. So, you know, and so I started going to AA. And then some people, they don't care about us people. One of them was my counselor, and she said, she talked to me for a long time. She said, you know, you seem to be a pretty intelligent guy, Amos. I said, yeah, but I keep messing up, you know. Every time I almost finish something, every time I'm close to doing something, I get drunk. And I had such low self-esteem, you know. She said to me, you're not a bad guy, Amos. And that's the first time in my life somebody told me I'm not a bad guy. My jaw dropped down to my chin, and he says, you're an alcoholic. You got a disease. But you can pretty much do what it takes in this world to go look for your daughter and finish school and do all that stuff you want to do if you don't take a drink and you go to work and you do the things that you got to do. So they talked me into going back to college. You know, and I'm 30 years old, and I went back to college, you know, and I was the oldest one in my class, and they called me Pops, and but I said, man, ain't nobody had a second chance like me. For all the years I've been on the streets and I had a chance to go back to college, I went back, and I used to be really good in the classroom when I was paying attention, you know, but, you know, I went back to school. I couldn't read anymore, you know, and I had a hard time with comprehension. All those blows to the head and all the drinking and all the stuff that I'd done. I couldn't retain stuff. So what I did was I stayed up all night. I still have a hard time sleeping. I only sleep 3 or 4 hours a night. But I stayed up all night and I studied and restudied and wrote it down, redid it over and over again. And I didn't have any money because I'd done messed up the tribal funding more than once. So a couple times a week I'd go down to this place called the Plasma. So my first semester when I went back to school, I sold my plasma twice a week. I get my shampoo, my toothbrush and all that stuff. But towards the end of the first semester, I started comprehending a little bit. But then the grades came out and I made the president's list, you know. Staying up all night, and then they did it a couple more times, and when I was ready to graduate, this is how I ended up in Vegas. I applied to these companies like IBM and all these fancy companies, and they'd look at my resume and then call up and look at my jail record, and they'd say, okay, thanks for your interest, you know, and they kind of forget about me, you know. And I must have put over 100 applications, and I got turned down every time. And I was ready to go back to Denver, and I know I could work on TVs. And I went back to school for electronics technician. And just before I was going to go back, my instructor said, there's somebody coming from Vegas, and I want you to go talk to him for me. And I said, well, he really treated me good, you know, this instructor, and he treated me like a human being. So I thought, well, okay, I'll just do it for him, you know. And I was just going to go with just regular t-shirt and stuff on, that's how I dress normally. And they said, no, Amos, my roommates got together and put a suit together for me. You know, I guess that's the first time I wore a suit in most of my life. And I went to the interview, and they had a big old long line of people. You know, these guys were all Air Force vets and you name it. And I was like the second guy there because I'd never hardly sleep, you know. Those sprinklers come on early. You're living in the parks, you know, and so I was like the second guy there, you know. And so this guy went, and then I went. And then he looked at my stuff, you know, and he started looking at it, and he says, I see you've been around a lot. And I said, you know, I raised my hand. I said, you know what? Well, I need to get this over with. You know, I know I ain't going to pass this interview anyway. So I told him I'm an alcoholic. You know what? I'm an alcoholic. And he said, he looked at me for a while and then he said, what made you stop? And I said, well, I'm not getting any younger. I'm almost 30 years old and then never going to get any better. And he said, okay. So how long has it been? Almost a couple of years now. And he said, okay. And then he started asking me for the technical questions and I passed them. And then he said, okay, thanks. So I went out of there and I said, no, I ain't going to get this. And I, just like 2 months before I graduated, so I was making plans going back up to Denver. And here, 4 days later, this guy called back and wanted more information on me. He said, I'm going to send you a pack to fill out so we can consider your application, right? So they sent me a pack and it was this thick. It's about an inch thick, you know. And they said, where have you been in the last 15 years? That's one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. Trying to figure where I've been in the last 15 years, you know. And then it says, list all the jobs you've had in the last 15 years. I said, okay, well, let's see. I've been self-employed a lot, you know. You know, and then the next thing they say is, list all the times you've been in jail, right? That was a good one. After about the second page, I got tired and went to sleep. Then I put, if I did it, if it's there, I probably did it, you know. And then I fill it all out and I send it in. And I said, nah, for sure they're not going to hire me, you know. And about 2 weeks later, they sent an application, offer in the mail. This company is called EG&G, if anybody ever heard of the company. So I said, okay, I sent it back, and they paid for my move out here. I'm still there, same company. You know, it's over almost 19 years now, you know, and next year I could retire if I want to. You know, that's coming from the streets, living under a tree to, you know, next year I can start drawing pension and do something else. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, all the time, I went to meetings every day, sometimes 3 or 4 times a day on Saturdays. So I don't know how to live without taking a drink. And these guys taught me how to go through situations without taking a drink, how to face life without getting too stressed out, how to not get in physical confrontations. That was my answer, you know. And how to pay my bills. You know, I didn't know anything about benefits. This guy, George, is talking about catfish. I thought benefit was a free meal, right? So I showed up at this job and they gave me a pack of this thick, and they say, okay, you get this insurance, that insurance, you do this, you do that. That was way over my head. I went over and gave it to Catfish, and Catfish looked at it and said, you don't want this, you don't want that. You know, he's throwing all this stuff out. And so you got to save 16%, or $16, 16%, I don't know which one, but he's put it, signed it down. So I've been doing that all these years, paying, you know. And in the meantime there, while I was doing all that, I came to Las Vegas and I started going to the men's downbeat group Monday night. And I was often wondering where my daughter was, you know. And they'd always say, you know what, you got to have faith in God. She'll show up when the time is right. So it took me like 5 years after I sobered up, and I finally found her. She was living in Winslow, and like when I found her, she didn't know who I was. You know, I got a chance to go pick her up on a vacation. I went down there and I waited a day, and they brought her back from the reservation up there, and she didn't know who I was, but they told her, that's your dad, you know. And so she got in a car with me, and, you know, all my life before that, I always make promises to people, to anybody, I'll do this and I'll do that. But if you put a drink in front of me, that promise is gone. I'd rather drink. And so I took her down to Walmart, and we started walking around, and I bought her some clothes, and she was looking at this bike, a little nice bike, with, you know, ribbons all over it. You could tell she wanted it, so I said, you can have it, you know. She didn't believe me. I grabbed it and I took it over to the checkout stand, and, you know, and she just couldn't believe it, you know. I said, yeah, you know. And then we went to vacation up there in Denver. She didn't know me, you know. She just knew me as Amos. And she didn't even hug me. She just, like, tell me when she's hungry, tell me when she needs to go to the bathroom, you know. And we got up to Denver and went to visit my sister for a while, and we went all over Colorado, you know, and not down Skid Row where I'm used to, you know. We went to the sites, you know, and carnivals and stuff like that. And on the way back, we stopped in Winslow and dropped her off, and she gave me a hug. You know, and then that was like in August, I mean, in July. And then I had contact with her, so I'd send her some money and I bought clothes and stuff, and I bought her school clothes. And that December, they said that I could keep her for the holidays, so I went after her. And when I got over there, they said, "You want to keep her?" You know, I said, "Yeah." So I brought her back. She was 9 years old, you know, and today she's 25, you know, and I've raised her, you know. You know, alcoholism runs deep. It's very bad. It's an insidious disease. It'll kill you. No matter how many times you've been in AA or whether you grew up in AA or not. She grew up in front of a Thai club. And she used to hang out with Texas Mike and John Todman. And one of them taught her how to stack a deck. I don't know which one did it, you know. But she's 9 years old. She's going, you know. And I was like, "Where'd you learn that?" And they also taught her not to tell on anybody. You know, she would never tell who did it, you know. I got to be a soccer dad, you know, and we went all over taking vacations and everything. And her mom sobered up and started talking to her mom. And when she's 13, she ran away, you know, back down there. She's used to that chaotic lifestyle. It's very hard to leave that. In the second step, it says her lifestyle seems the only normal one, even no matter how rough it is. And she went back, and about a year or so later, you know, I moved to Wyoming, one of my good ideas, and she came to live with me, and I found out she was pregnant. She was 14, you know, and she had a baby when she was 15. That's Lucas, you know. And then I had, you know, what am I going to do? Put the baby back, you know. You know, and I started raising him, taking care of him. And then a couple of years later, she took off again. And then a while later, she came back. She had a little girl. That's Leah. You know? She's 7. They live with me yet, you know. And I have a good time with them guys, you know. I must be the same age as them mentally, because I sure have a good time. You know. You know? We go fishing together, we just have a good time, you know, and that's what it's about, you know, and having time and being able to laugh, being able to cry, being able to live life to the fullest. And, you know, four and a half years ago, she came back, and she didn't say nothing. She just came back. I was just happy to have her back, and she didn't say nothing. She just started going AA, you know. She's been AA a lot of times, and she went and got working on her GED. And she started gaining a little weight, you know. And how are you going to tell your daughter she's gaining weight, you know? So I said, "You know what, I got this corporate gym membership." Go over there. She didn't say nothing. And then it was like in the spring, she came with little gram things. That's a baby. And I said, "Who, which one is that, Lucas or Leo?" She said, "That's a new one." She was pregnant again, you know, and didn't tell me. And the little baby was born May 31st, 4 years ago. And the dad didn't even show up. Dad didn't even try to show up. I was in the delivery room. And so the baby had my last name, you know. And so I, you know, put the baby home, and everybody, all my friends were there. And, you know, and then my daughter had this, what you call, some kind of syndrome. Just went in depression for a couple of months, and I had to really talk to her about, you know, you got to take care of these other guys, you know, you got to help her out, help these guys out. Postpartum, you got called in. Finally, I had to, you know, really hard being a parent. You're really hard trying to get these kids to do something when their whole life's been chaotic. And so I said, you know, I was buying a house, another house, so I said, "You can have this one. Your job is right over there. You know, and then I'll be right over there if you need me." She didn't want to live alone. She said, "I'm going to go to Albuquerque. And I'm going to go to school over there." So, much as I hated to, my sponsor said, "She's an adult now. You got to take her." You know, so I took her down there, and he came from South Dakota to be with me at that time. And then, so I left her in Albuquerque, you know, and then, And then I had a tough time coming back, and this was like Labor Day, and she was up there a couple of months, and I got a call on November 1st that the little baby passed away with, what do you call them, SIDS, you know, and that was tough. I'm telling you, I went to like depression for over almost 3 years, you know, because of the guilt feelings of taking her down there, but you know what, I went to AA every day, I went to work with sponsees, I did all the stuff that AA taught me to do, that I could walk through this, and, I finally was able to start talking about it last year. It took me over 3 years. And I didn't have to drink over it, because AA says you don't have to drink over anything. You know, job, no job, wife, no wife, death, anything like that. You don't have to drink over it. Because taking a drink is never going to bring anybody back. Taking a drink is never going to make the situation any better. And so she finally came back last year. I had to kick her out because she couldn't stop drinking. And those little kids went back to their dad. I had to kick her out. I don't know where she went. It's tough. It's tough when you have to rely on God, because but He's got more power than me. You know, He's infinite. His power is infinite, and I don't have any power. I just gotta have to rely on Him. And He did His job, you know, because I just go to AA. That's my job, and help a newcomer. Don't drink. And one morning she showed up at an AA meeting. And that was a year ago. I think she's got a year of sobriety now, you know. And so we went after the little guys. They still remembered me, you know. And they still hang around, you know, I still hang around them. Today, after this meeting, I got taken down to Arizona, because they're going to go visit their grandma on the other side for the summer. They're part Apache, so they got to go down there. The White River, Arizona. You know what? I can do that. You know, because I can learn how to. The situation is different, and I can trust God today that everything's gonna work out. Would never have been able to do that one time. So that's part of that. As far as my, you know, in my job, I even got a white guy working for me now. You know? Imagine that. Yeah. And you know what? He loves me, you know? Every time I'm going to do something, boy, he runs all over trying to get it for me, you know? One of the worst things is they're going to take him away from me. Oh, man. You know? I've got nine guys now, you know? And it's okay today. I don't have the fantastic ups and fantastic downs. I'm kind of down in the middle. With alcohol, you know, with life in general. I know that no matter what happens, everything's gonna be alright in the end. I didn't have that when I got here. I thought the world was gonna end about 10 minutes ago, you know. And I thought that way all the time. I got a whole bunch of friends today, and I've had friends for years, you know. Back in the old days, I'd go through 3 sets of friends on 1 weekend. The only guys that never did kick me out were the cops, you know. They'd say, come on in, Amos, you know. And then when I went to treatment, I was the first one in my family to go to treatment, or go to AA. And every time, you know, I'd go to this treatment place, and some family members would come, and they have a picnic, you know, on front, and everybody would be all lovey-dovey and stuff. And boy, I'd get mad, because never happened to me, you know. My family came to borrow money. And then one of them would try to fight me if I didn't lend him money. You know, this is in treatment, you know. And I'm saying, man, you know, there's no justice in this world, you know. But you know what they told me? That no matter what, you got to be sober, because you may be the only example of the big book anybody will ever see. The fantastic thing is, you know, when my big brother Lester, the one that used to come to the treatment center, he died a couple of years ago. He was 5 years sober, you know. And then I sobered up, and I was sitting there talking to my big brother. I was trying to explain to him how to find a higher power, trying to work on that. And he's looking at me funny, and he says, are you an AA? And I said, yeah. And he says, me too, you know. And I got 3 weeks on him, you know. And he's 10 years older than me. My last drink was February 2nd, 1984. I'm going on my 22nd year now. You know, I haven't been in jail in that long, too. That's good, you know. That's the good part. And then a little bit later, my sister was looking and she said, you know what, I got a year today. She's going to have 20 years this year. And then all the rest of them start coming in, my brothers and sisters and stuff, and they're all sober now. Most of them, a lot of them don't go to AA, but they're all sober. And, you know, when we get together, back in the old days, there'd be at least two, three cop cars, the ambulance, and, you know, the fire truck, and somebody'd always pass out with a cigarette or, you know, trying to cook and pass out, you know, and now, last in March, we had a family get together and a pizza truck showed up with about 30 pizzas, you know, and we all laughed and had a good time. We're still friends. You know, in the old days, I didn't see a brother like 5 years, and I seen him, we got in a fight the same night. Something happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago when I was a kid. I remember that, you know. And then we got into that over that, you know. Paradise, but it's pretty close. It's pretty close for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has done stuff. It's transformed somebody that's hated everybody to where I'm accepting, and I still don't like a lot of people, but I could live with that, you know. And I'm become a productive member of Alcoholics Anonymous and society, you know. If you don't think it works, just believe that we, you know, that we know it does. If you're a newcomer, they told me that you go to meetings. First thing you got to do is don't drink one day at a time, okay? And then go to meetings, get a sponsor, get that book. So this one, it's the least read book around. No, anyway, and then work with a newcomer, and you do those things on a daily basis, and your life will turn around. I've had a lot of friends that passed on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've lost three sponsors and passed away. I'm my fourth sponsor now, and George has been my friend all this time, and he's always supported me. And we buried one of our good buddies last spring, Catfish. Catfish was two days short of his 35th birthday, but we decided he's going to have 35 anyway, you know. And I was there for his funeral, and felt honored to be invited by his family. Well, one of my sponsors passed away in Hawaii. But, you know, those guys showed me courage because they went through real bad stuff, but they never complained. I was always grateful that they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they was always able to talk to me and always want to help me out if I needed something. That's what these elders taught me. In my tribe, we got people that are, I'm one of them now, I guess, elder, that got good advice. In AA, we got the old-timers, and they showed the way for us to live sober and have a happy, productive life. I generally go to the Thai club. That's my hangout. And you can find me there sometime during the week. Yeah, I try to live honestly. I'm down to three lies a day. If we believe that, I got riches, Sally. You know? And this AA's 70th birthday. It could take anybody and make them something completely different. All you have to do is actions contrary to our thinking, they say. You know? Actions contrary to our thinking. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill W., Dr. Bob, and all the old-timers that carried this program on through dark times and to where it's now. Thank you very much.